No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, was Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in with any questions at 888-627-6008. We have an amazing guest tonight, Representative Tom Davis. Marilia, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Mike. How are you?
I'm good.
Are you enjoying the snow?
Yeah, I'm worried. I've got to go out. Tomorrow's Martin Luther King Day, and we're doing things in Anacostia, and I'm an old guy, so I'm worried about, you know, getting out of my car and getting out there. But we have an amazing guest tonight.
We do indeed.
Representative Tom Davis. Congressman Davis, are you with us?
I certainly am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you great. You sound great. And for those of you who don't know, who might not know, Congressman Davis is a Republican from Virginia who was in Congress for 14 years, representing the 11th District of Virginia. He created over 100 pieces of legislation in his time in the House. He was chairman of the House Oversight and Government Affairs Committee, and important to every Washingtonian, he was the chief architect of a thing called the D.C. Voting Rights Act, which would have given the District of Columbia a vote in the House of Representatives for the first time ever. And so we welcome him to the show and want to know what's going on today. We know you work for Holland and Knight Congressman. So let me start by asking you, do you miss being up on the Hill?
Do you miss high school? I mean, the answer is yeah. No. I'm grateful for the opportunity that it gave me. You talked about 100 pieces of legislation. That was legislation signed into law. I sponsored a lot more, including D.C. voter rights. But we had 100 pieces signed into law. Prolific legislator. I also, your listeners ought to know, I left Congress undefeated and unindicted, something I'm very, very proud of. So it's...
It's sad that you have to say that these days.
Touche.
Well, you got to, on the D.C. Council, even more so. I mean, with the history, but you got it, politically, it's everywhere. But look, I've been the rector of George Mason University the last 6 years. I just stepped down from that. I was term limited. And I am a president of the Federal City Council, which is, a very large business group in the city.
Yes.
And I've been part of a couple successful startups out here in Northern Virginia and part of a couple more going well. So life's been pretty good, and I stay active in politics. I can pick and choose who I like.
Well, and D.C. never had a better friend, actually. We have a few neighbors that are good friends, and you and Jerry Connolly and several other people in Virginia. Even when Virginia was tough for us, you know, Mark Warner is a guy that I worked with at the DNC. We worked in the same division, but it took us a long time to get Senator Warner to sign on to statehood. Same thing with Steny Hoyer in Maryland. There's always been conflict between D.C. and its neighbors, especially on the issue of equal rights. So we certainly appreciate things you've done.
Yeah. let me differentiate, just so I think it's important listeners understand the difference between voting rights in Congress, in the House, yeah. the Senate, and statehood. They are all different arguments. And if I could, let me just go through them and we
yeah,
can talk
please.
About them.
Please.
And the pluses and the minuses. My bill, which I did get through the House, in fact, 23 Republicans voted for it, would have given the district a vote in the House of Representatives, a vote. Now they have a representative. She's been very able and a strong advocate, but she only gets yeah. to vote in committee and in the Democratic Conference. She doesn't vote mm-hmm. on the floor. This would have given the city a vote. Our research showed this could be done, by the Congress. You didn't need a constitutional amendment to do this, that under the district clause of the Constitution. In fact, Ken Starr testified before this, before our committee. We picked up 23 Republican votes, including, just to tell you, Darrell Issa, Mike Pence, Paul Ryan. So I think thinking Republicans went beyond the politics of this and recognized that maybe a congressional vote in the capital of the free world, in the cradle of democracy, was significant and looked beyond the partisan ramifications of that, were able to vote for that. Now, the Senate's more complicated because, as you know, senators represent states, whereas representatives represent people. And with D.C. not being a state, we could not make that same argument and move the bill through Congress. That would have taken a constitutional amendment. There are two ways to do that. One is you could have the district vote with another state and include those votes in the vote of Maryland or Virginia. In the first 12 years mm-hmm. of the Republic, the people that now live where the district is did vote for Congress. On the Virginia side, which was, as you know, retroceded in 1846, they voted with Virginia. And on the Maryland side, they voted with Maryland. Now, senators in those days were elected by legislatures. It was not a popular vote, so you don't mm-hmm. have really quite the same argument you have for a representative. But think of it this. The House at one point had voted to move the government to Philadelphia. And it was a long compromise having to do with the Revolutionary War debt and everything else that they decided to move it to Washington. And they never got around to addressing the voting issue there because in 1801, when it moved, the presidential election went to the House of Representatives, and they just never got it done. I always said, look, if it had gone to New York, you don't think New York would have been without congressional representation. Or to Philadelphia, that they would have been without it. But because it was a new jurisdiction created right there, they just never got around to addressing this. And it was, it wasn't really an issue, I think, for generations. And in the 60s, when the city got the vote for president, it started to become a civil rights issue. We had newly enfranchised voters that had been excluded for generations and the like. And so that's where statehood really comes in. Now, the argument against statehood, of course, is a strong one in the sense that there should be a federal enclave at some point that the federal government controls and is not at the mercy of any state. And that goes back to an episode in 1783 when you had some pensioners from the Revolutionary War marched on the Continental Congress or the Congress under the Articles of Confederation. The local militia were sympathetic and wouldn't guard it, and they chased the Congress up to Trenton. And at that point, James Madison and others said, we need our own federal district. And that's the basis for this. But as you know, under statehood, they shrink the federal district and they make the rest a state. And the problem now is it's gotten really down into partisan politics. The city is the most Democratic unit in the country if it were to be a state. I think the maximum a Republican's ever gotten for president since they started voting was Richard Nixon in 1968 when he was getting 60% of the vote nationally. He got 21% in D.C. And in these hard partisan times, members can't look through their partisan lens to just hand over two senators in a closely divided Senate. I think it all gets caught up. If that just lays a predicate for the issue and the different lenses that Republicans and Democrats view it.
Absolutely. But, I once heard you, Congressman, in a lecture that you gave. I can't remember where we were, but you said there's only two things you can do to a politician. And I got to tell you, I've repeated this many, many times. You said you can either hurt them or help them. So how do we get to Republicans? Any idea how we get to Republicans and we either hurt them or help them?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the problem on the statehood issue is I think Republicans are just going to say what you're asking us to get two more Democratic senators. I mean, if the city were a little more balanced in its politics, I don't think you'd have that same issue. You'd have other issues, but I think they could be overcome. Remember, when Alaska and Hawaii were admitted to the Union, the last two states to be admitted, one was a more Republican state and one was a more Democratic state, and they brought them kind of in tandem, a year apart. That's been in the old days. They had slave states brought in with free states. They try to keep that balance and not upset it. My favorite is Colorado, which the Republicans snuck into the Union in 1876 in their three electoral votes. They were admitted in August of 1876. They didn't have time for an election, but the legislature was controlled by Republicans, so they sent three electoral votes there for Rutherford B. Hayes, who ended up winning by one vote. But there's always been politics in admission of states. And the city, you know, I don't think they can escape that. It would be, if you had any elected Republicans in the city, it would be a little better. Of course, the Republicans had one, Carol Schwartz, but as Republicans, we eat our own. Mm-hmm. And they defeated her in a primary, and since that time, there hasn't been any Republicans on council, even though two seats on the council are reserved for the members who are not part of the majority party. The irony in this, Michael, is that Michael, a different Michael Brown, was on the city council running as an independent. And he would appear on CNN, and underneath him it would say Democratic political consultant. But they just ran as independents. Everybody knew what they were. And so you don't get that diversity of opinion within the council or anybody that can go back as an ambassador to Republicans to make these arguments. And it's just been very difficult.
Yeah, it certainly has. Marilia, I'm sorry. I seem to be taking up all the time here. Do you have a question for the time?
Please. Yes, yeah, I do. Ahead. And it's not directly related to...
Oh, it doesn't have to be. Go ahead.
Okay. Statehood. But hello, Tom, and it's lovely to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I would like to ask you about the contract with America. And basically, you were elected to the House in 94 when Gingrich introduced that contract with America.
Right.
I was introduced before the 94 election, for better or for worse, but it was a cohesive, purposeful, and sort of communal bit of future intentions for intentions for future legislation. A lot of it was about reform, and Americans wanted to see that in government, I imagine, although very divisively, they would want to see that now. But it was, as you know, basically written by the Conservative Heritage Foundation and promulgated before the midterm and basically taken from Reagan's State of the Union in 1985. But there was strength in numbers, and Gingrich, you know, got it through. It helped them win in 94. Granted, it was the midterm, which typically leads to a House and or Senate changing parties, but still, the House gained 54 seats and the Senate 9 seats. So my question is, why do you think the Democrats are unable to or don't ever come up with a similar approach with at least the Democratic Party to appeal to the Democratic Party to sort of get cohesiveness and everybody behind the same ball, if not beyond? Why do you think that is? Why do you think the Republicans are always able to do that?
Yeah, let me make a couple of comments. Will Rogers once said, "I'm not a member of an organized party, I'm a Democrat." and the Democrat coalition is very dissonant, and we could spend the whole show talking about there are parts of the coalition that are identity politics, the parts that are progressive, you know, et cetera,
indeed,
et cetera. And mm-hmm. pick that apart. I always said, as a Republican candidate, you need to pick their coalition apart because it is fairly dissonant, and so is the Republican to some extent. What the Republicans did 1994 is they had been out of power in the House for 40 years. 40 years.
Right.
And Gingrich wanted to show, don't be afraid. And what they did is, yeah, a lot of these ideas came from Heritage, but they all polled very well. There wasn't any issue on abortion, for example. They didn't get into the real controversial. These were issues that polled 60, 70%. And they put this out there and had people sign. Now, we had a couple Republicans wouldn't sign it because they didn't like an immigration provision or a tax. But by and large, most of us signed it. I remember I was chairman of the county board in Fairfax.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at my campaign manager. I said, should I sign it? And he says, sign it. Members didn't even know what they signed. But it was marketed well. I can have a lengthy discussion about its relevancy to my campaign. But remember, Republicans had been out of power for 40 years, and they were trying to show Americans, you know, give us the keys to the kingdom. This is what we're going to do. We're not going to scare you. It was a midterm election. Now, look, midterm elections, I was campaign chairman for the Republicans in 2000 and 2002, a presidential year and a midterm, and I can tell you the dynamics, if you will, the atmospherics of those elections are very, very different between a midterm and presidential.
Absolutely.
Presidential races are generally choices, a direction of the country. It's do you choose A or do you choose B? They're choice elections, and each party puts out its competing visions, and voters get that choice. Midterm elections, though, if you look at the history over the last 150 years, have generally been referendums on the incumbent. And that's why only three times in those 150 years has the president's party picked up seats. I was campaign chairman for one of those three. And Martin Frost, who's a Democrat from Texas, the co-author of the book I wrote, was for one of the other sites. And we can tell you why the 1998 and 2002 were different. But if you're Republican right now, you want to make this election about Joe Biden and his performance. You don't want to bring it back to Donald Trump, right? Because Biden's numbers right now are in the tank. Whatever you think about his policies, and you can argue for or against them, but they're having bad results on the ground. COVID is still not under control. You've got rapid inflation, the worst that we've had in 40 years. You've got a border that's leaking. Foreign policy, it was an embarrassment with Afghanistan, and Biden's numbers are sunk. And Democrats, if you get a choice, do I want to give Biden a blank check or do I want to put a check on Biden? Republicans win that. And we saw in the Virginia governor's race, Virginia is still a pretty blue state, has a blue tinge to it, but independents broke by over 20 points for the Republicans. They just wanted to send Biden and the Democrats a message. And so under those circumstances, which are different from 1994, if you're Republicans, you don't want to have a contract with America at this point. And if you're a Democrat, you're probably going to want to, in any kind of a swing district, you probably want to run your own race. You probably don't want to get caught up on, do you like Joe Biden or not?
Well, you know what? Let me ask you a question in that regard, Congressman. Let's, as a Democrat, I hope that Virginia is not a bellwether for the Democrats, but the governor's race. But you've got Representative Jim Jordan and Lindsey Graham making jokes about Biden being like Jimmy Carter, a guy that I worked for. And, you know, Carter, right, I think history has recorded Carter as the president that we chose because of what happened in Watergate, what happened with Nixon. We're looking for a nice, honest guy, whether he was a good president or not. And don't we have this, and he was a one-term president. And don't we have the same situation with Joe Biden in the sense that the country wanted somebody to bring us back to normalcy? And with the Republican Party marching in lockstep with Donald Trump, don't they really hurt their chances in 2024, if Trump is your candidate, don't you think you'll lose?
So I would say this. First of all, your analogy to Carter is right in the sense that people voted for Carter because they just wanted to go a different direction. They wanted to kind of take a shower after Watergate. And Jimmy Carter was a fresh face. Now, unlike Biden, who was the consummate insider, Carter was the consummate outsider. But to the extent that it was kind of a return to normalcy, that they were elected because people did not like the way things were going, I think that is that's completely accurate. My own read is that people voted for Joe Biden because a significant part of the electorate, who is open, was open to both sides, just didn't want Donald Trump in their living room for four more years, and they saw Joe Biden as a stabilizing influence. As I've, as one Democratic member, Spanberger from Virginia, said, she said, "We elected Joe Biden to be normal, not to be the next FDR." And as often happens when people win elections, is they misread their mandate. I remember telling John Boehner when the Republicans took back the House in 2010, John, they rejected us in 2006 and 2008. They're not in love with this. They're just trying to send a message. He's moving too fast. And I think we're seeing with Biden, again, overreading the mandate, getting tremendous pressure from the Democratic base. And as you look at both parties' caucuses, these are members from single-party districts who only worry about their primary. And that has moved the Republican caucus right and the Democratic caucus left. And then if you can add Trump and his personal following on top of that to the Republican side, because not everything he does I would regard as conservative. That adds, I think, you know, an added equation for the Republicans to how do you handle this going into a midterm.
Well, you know, I would say you've got some really good candidates out there, Congressman. You've got, in my opinion, as a Democrat, you've got John Kasich, Mitt Romney, Larry Hogan. There's a lot of kind of moderate Republicans, I think, that could, you know, that scare me as a Democrat and could make Joe Biden a one-term president. But if the how do you get those? Is there any way to get those people past the primary? We had Michael Steele on the show, and Michael Steele told us that Larry Hogan wouldn't run for the nomination because he couldn't get past the primary. Is that true?
I think that's probably it's very difficult. I mean, I think you could see this coming in 2008 with McCain. The party base wasn't happy with McCain, but they saw him as the most electable, so they went with him. McCain, I think, wanted to go with maybe a Joe Lieberman for a vice president, or maybe Tom Ridge, but didn't think they could get them through the convention, and they end up with Sarah Palin. And then 2012, Romney is a nominee. He wasn't the heart of the party, but he was the person they thought they could win, and then they both lost. By the way, I always say Democrats and their allies skewered these people. They skewered McCain, and they skewered Romney with some of the same vitriol they went after Trump, because this is what happens in campaigns. It's always an exaggeration. And so Republicans just went back with Trump, and Trump, we had seen before the Republican base migrating from the country club to the country. It was becoming a more rural party. Part of this were environmental issues. Part of this were cultural issues, you know, guns, abortion, those kind of traditional issues. And Trump saw this. And then when he came out against free trade, he added a lot of blue-collar Democrats that had been voting, labor folks that had been voting Democrat on kind of economic issues. He brought them back into the Republican. He brought them into the Republican Party. And this was a straight-out culture war. Now, it cost Republicans in your high-income, high-education areas, but they cleaned up in rural areas. And my favorite county when I look at this is Elliott County, Kentucky, had never voted for a president of the Republican Party in history, and they gave Trump 70%. Like Robeson County, North Carolina, huge swing there. You look up to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, in the area. There's swings among traditional Democrats who just moved over because Donald Trump recognized something that John Kasich, who was my candidate, and other candidate, Jeb Bush and others, didn't recognize. And that is there was a group of white Americans out there who felt they had been ridiculed and laughed at by the establishment for years. Nobody was paying attention to them. Donald Trump had done reality TV for a decade. He talked to these people. He understood them in a way that many of the rest of us didn't. And it was a very emotional connection to him. And it just shocked the Republican world. I was up in New Hampshire with John Kasich and was ringing doors, and it, you know, it surprised me. But everybody looks at life through different lenses. And as you talk to these folks, we could see this was going to be a serious problem for Republicans, particularly more moderate members from suburban areas. And the feeling was Trump didn't have a chance to win. That was our conventional wisdom. Little did we know that he ended up winning the presidential race, and he could win it again in 2024 unless Biden or the Democrats can pull themselves back, because right now they're just having terrible results on the ground, you know, with the issues I talked about before.
Well, you know, I feel, Congressman, that that's always been the Achilles heel of the Democratic Party, is that we talk down to the world. You know, you don't want a gun. You're just smart enough you're not smart enough to realize that. So we're going to explain it to you, rather than sitting down and talking to people. And I've seen that in the 40 years that I've been with the Democratic Party. So
that's a great point.
Go ahead.
We see climate change. Those of us that study them, we recognize that climate's changing and the effect of greenhouse gases. But when you start the conversation, we're going to shut down oil and gas, or we're going to shut down coal, you people start digging in. We know at the end of the day we need to come together on this, that we're going to need to do more carbon capture. We're going to have to do more research and development in terms of how we do these things. We're going to have to move in this area. But when the first sentence out of your mouth is we're going to put a lot of coal miners out of work, hell, they're already out of work if you look at the statistics. You know, we're going to shut down oil and gas. People, constituencies dig in. And for the most part, if you look at that business, you know, that's a blue-collar business. These are workers. You want to explain the Hispanic movement in South Texas? A lot of it goes just to energy policies of the Democratic Party. Democrats in Texas were making huge inroads in the major counties, Bayer County, Dallas County, Harris County, certainly Austin, running up huge margin in metro areas, some of which used to be Republican bastions. But South Texas was moving the other way, part of it on cultural, but part of it on environmental issues. And these are Hispanics that Democrats thought were a natural part of their constituency. Well, they were in an identity politics sense, but when you start moving the economics in there, it didn't seem to fit there. So, look, it's complicated as we walk through, but I've always been one, you know, coming out of local government in Fairfax, where you sit around the table and you figure out what's doable. That's how I was able to pass a lot of laws, and nowadays that kind of behavior gets punished in primaries. You sit down with the other side, you get punished in primaries. The more outrageous you are, the more likely you are to raise money online, and the more likely you are to get on cable news, right and left. I don't think anybody's got a monopoly. Both parties have these issues. You look at Democratic fundraising in the House after Pelosi, I think it's AOC's the second biggest fundraiser. On the Republican side, after McCarthy, I think their largest fundraiser is Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is, you know, in Congress, couldn't pass, you know, couldn't get a bill or amendment through, couldn't get it through the caucus. But because outrageous behavior is rewarded in this day and age, on the right and the left, we're getting more and more of it. And these single-party districts are a huge part of this. For 80% of the House, the only race that matters is the primary. If you're running in the district, Michael, you don't worry about Republican voters. I don't mean you don't care about them, but they play no role, you know, in your election. You've got to win the Democratic primary. And so you cater to those voters. And they are not in the district, they're very dominant. But in most places in the country, they may be dominant, but they're not the only voters out there. But members go back and say, I talked to my constituents. They're talking to their party base because the primary is what elects them. The general election in most of these districts is nothing more than a constitutional formality.
Well, you know, excuse me, Marilia, I'll let you go in a second, but defund the police, that was the one for me, Congressman. As soon as they started... Because, you know, I do a lot of work in Anacostia and other places. People in those neighborhoods don't really want to defund the police. They want reform. But you know, exactly what you're saying, to come out and say, to use the terminology, defund the police, to invoke the image that you're going to shut police departments down. That's I think, a classic example of what you're talking about. I'm sorry, Marilia, go ahead.
No worries, Mike. Congressman, you mentioned John Kasich, and I would just like to say that I worked on the Kasich campaign. He was my choice, hands down. I didn't even have to think. Donald Trump was definitely not. But I ran his Hawaii and Pacific campaign because I was living in Hawaii at the time. And you mentioned that, and it's obviously true, that Trump read the populace. He read people in terms of voters' desires and needs and wants. And he was in touch with people. But Kasich was, too, in a very genuine and authentic way, in which Trump wasn't. Trump has, as I'm sure his niece would agree, sociopathic tendencies to read people, just like, and I hate to be hyperbolic about this, just like Hitler did. And it's just how the brain works. But he did it in a way that was completely self-serving, whereas John Kasich has genuine empathy and genuine concern for the welfare of the American citizen. So what is the difference between Kasich and Trump in that Kasich was not able to appeal?
Look, I think Kasich, and you look at his reelect in Ohio, which was 70%. I think John would have run even stronger than Trump. So I will just say that, and that's having, you know, run the campaign committee twice, written book teaching this stuff. I think that these blue-collar workers were coming to the Republican Party anyway. They've been moving in that direction. And Governor Kasich would have had a lot more appeal, I think, in your higher-income suburban areas, Orange County, California, Fairfax, Virginia, and done very well there. So I think it would have been a different race, but I think Kasich would have run stronger. I felt that way. I still feel that way. I will say this. I think when we start throwing out terms like comparisons to Hitler, racism, they're thrown out so routinely now that where they may actually apply, they just fall on deaf ears. It's just part of the political lexicon that people utilize. Donald Trump was a lot of things that gave me some concern. He was certainly unconventional. His characterization of John McCain, I thought, was off the rails. Firing the FBI director, in a press release. A guy like Comey, you call him in and you say, this isn't working out. He even fired Rance Priebus, had been RNC chairman, and he fires. I mean, you say, Rance, this isn't working. Can I find something else for you? Can I give you an ambassador? That's the way people that come up from where I come in politics handle those kind of a little smoother. Trump was from, he was from the Queens. He was very rough around the edges. Some people really like that. I will tell you this, my suburban neighbors out here who agreed with Trump on a lot of the economic issues in particular, they just found it revolting. And it ended up costing him more than he picked up, and I think you can look at the returns. But I don't put him in the same category as a Hitler or anything else. He was just very, very unconventional. He made a lot of people uncomfortable. And I always say it out here, Michael, in the suburbs in Fairfax, where I'm from, there were a lot of Youngkin signs out here this year. I worked on the Youngkin campaign. I thought all along we were going to win it. You could kind of feel it. People, Youngkin signs all over. You put a Trump sign up in my neighborhood, it was a hate crime. So it goes back to what you were saying in terms of his perception among a lot of people. And of course, the January 6th, and we can get into the whole thing of this. But I'm always more careful. Try to see the good in people as we move forward, and just recognize Trump is a force majeure in politics that is going to have to. Republicans are going to have to decide how they handle him in the midterm, and in the coming general election. If he becomes dominant in the midterm election, this becomes a choice election between Trump and Biden. And I think Republicans still take the House, but I think it it lowers the ceiling in terms of what they can get, as opposed to making this a referendum on Joe Biden and Democrats. Does that explain it, at least from my perspective?
Yeah, the only thing I would say...
A lot of people agree with you on Trump. I'm not saying, I don't put it in the same category, but I tend to be more analytical on this stuff, but I hear you.
And let me just say, I don't mean to say he's like Hitler. I mean, we just have a few moments to express ourselves on the show. When I say Hitler, it sounds hyperbolic, but it's not. But if you look at the psychology of Trump, and my dad was a psychiatrist. I have studied the brain. I've dissected the human brain. I've written about the brain. When I say Hitler, it is a comparison of the sociopathic tendencies, and in his case, the sociopathic tendencies that allow him to appeal to people, just like Ted Bundy did. It's all in a psychological continuum, and I'm not saying he was Hitler, but he had the same diagnosis, if you will, in terms of the sociopathy, in terms of the pathological tendencies that he has to appeal to people. And I and any psychologist would say, yes, that is true. But again, I'm not saying he was like Hitler. He you know, would not enact a Holocaust, but he, I don't have time to explain it psychologically or neurobiologically, but he does. He shares that. So, you know, I didn't mean to say he was, just to explain it to you, the argument still holds.
And I don't want to argue. I'm just telling you, I didn't view it from through the same lenses. I do think this is a person, though, who had a connection with a wide body of Americans that most of mainstream politicians ignored.
Right. Well, it is not genuine like Kasich's was, is my point. Kasich has the same connection, if you will, would have had a better connection had he had better press and media coverage. But he has the same. But his is
background. I agree with you. I agree with you.
Yeah.
And given that, Congressman, since the rhetoric from Donald Trump, for example, is not getting any less vitriolic, again, what does that do to you guys in 2024? I mean, if he's your candidate, can he win? Do you think he can win? He couldn't win at the height of his popularity.
Michael, I think he would win today if it were the two of them. Now, there's a long way to go. I mean, just a long way to go. And because I think right now he's been off Twitter for a year. I mean, people kind of forget, you know what I mean? You kind of fade in the background, and you look at President Obama's numbers are much better today than when he was in office. George W. Bush's numbers. I mean, as time fades sometimes, people forget some of the things that irritated, and they go on to the next victim, in this case, Biden. He could win. He may not win. It may be vicious. I tend to believe that if you were to get a Biden or Harris on the Democratic versus a Trump, you'd have a third party try to come in that could have some significance. But who knows? I mean, it's just a long way to go. I'm not convinced at this point that Donald Trump gets nominated in 3 years. He's got a series of midterm primaries that he has made endorsements. He will win some of them. He will lose some of them. And depending on how some of those races come out, you know, once the patina is gone, he doesn't look like he's the kingmaker on everything, people will get a little more independent. But we just don't know how this shows up and how he plays it. And at the end of the day, I think he certainly has a strong following within the party, but there are a lot of Republicans that would prefer to go a different direction. They're just not saying anything right now, and I think they're looking for some signs of weakness. In an ironic way, President Trump may be helped because he's not on Twitter, that he's not out there building some of the negatives that had tremendous positives for him in communicating his message. That have had a lot of negatives with people reminding you every day, saying things that people didn't agree with.
Well, I've got to agree with you about the popularity thing. My popularity is certainly much greater with my children now that they're all grown than when they were teenagers. I wasn't their most popular candidate when they were teenagers, but they seem to like me more now. Let me just change the subject for a moment because. This is so important to us here in D.C. The road to statehood for us is pretty clear in the Senate. The first thing we need to do is get rid of the filibuster, because we're never going to get 60 people on our bill. But so what do you think, Congressman? The filibuster, is it a tool, or is it just, a vestige of Jim Crow?
Well, as you know, it didn't start with Jim Crow. The filibuster
existed
long before that. In fact, the first usage was basically stopping a censor resolution on Andrew Jackson. It has been part of, it's not part of the Constitution. It grew up procedurally. It's a very two-edged sword. If you listen to Sinema's comments, if you're in the moment and you're a Democrat right now, say, how could somebody say this? But let me give you the other side of this, Michael. Let's go back a few years when Republicans were frustrating a number of Obama nominees. Democrats controlled the Senate, but Republicans were holding up a number of his nominees because of the 60-vote threshold. And Harry Reid utilized what he called the nuclear option at that point.
Right.
And said, look, we're just going to go with 50 votes. And I understand why he did. We all understand why he did it. And it made sense at the time for Democrats. But fast forward, Trump gets in, and all of a sudden you've got three Supreme Court nominees. Now, they changed the rule. They did it for everything but the Supreme Court, and the Republicans said, well, we did it for everything else, we're going to do it for the Supreme Court. I don't think they would have done that for the Supreme Court had the Democrats not taken the initial action on nominations. So it may make sense today, but I will tell you down the road it's going to come back and bite you. Because when Republicans, if Trump takes it and you've got a Republican Senate and a Republican House, your voting rights and everything else, what they're doing in Georgia, will be nationalized. And so, it's a very two-edged sword, and I just, this is a different era now. We have, both with voters and politicians, they don't act like this is a balance of power structure. You know, we were constructed as a balance of powers, checks and balances, and it was reason people would be able to come together. Now you have very unreasonable people not coming together and acting like it's a parliamentary system where impeachments are becoming more like no confidence votes, and this stuff is just routine, egged on by the party bases. We talked about the single-party districts, but there's another element to this, and that is people don't tune into the news to get information anymore. They tune in to get affirmation. They tune in to get their worldviews valid, and they walk around like they know what's going on. Everybody else is just stupid, and it doesn't help if you can't deal with the same set of facts. I like local government because we all dealt from the same set of facts. There were just a handful of us in the room, and you didn't want anybody to go away too mad because you needed them on the next vote. But at the national level, it's red jerseys versus blue jerseys every day. And sometimes you think, do we care about the country? This infrastructure bill that Biden's signed, this bill didn't come from Biden. It didn't come from Democratic leaders. It didn't come from – it was a group of members in the Senate, Kyrsten Sinema being one, who said, we need an infrastructure bill. And they went to Schumer and they said, look, we've got 13 Republicans. We've got enough to overcome it. We need to move this bill through. We've been trying to get an infrastructure bill through for over a decade. And 19 Republicans voted for it in the Senate. But by the time it got over to the House, it started getting used as a political prop for Build Back Better. You only got 13 Republicans in the House. I mean, it's just gotten so partisanized. And it's not the way the founders intended. It doesn't work very well. But until the voters get sick of it, and as long as members only worry about their primary voters and independent voters just take the choices they're given instead of getting in early on these nomination fights and nominating people who can reason together, we're going to get more of it.
Well, given that,
Congressman,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead,
Congressman. We wish you were in the House again and the Senate.
Brilliant.
You
my
really
friend.
Are. What's that? That's right. I'm trying to put you back in high school, right? No, you really are. You're brilliant, and it's amazing listening to you. But what do you think on all that? As a footnote, what do you think could be done to change this? I mean, there's not one cure, of course, but
well, on the filibuster, for example, you could have a talking filibuster. Right now, it's all notices, right? You just did notices. In the old days, they had to talk. you sat there and you had to talk around the clock, and that wears a lot of people down. And you're in Washington 24/7. After a while, people say, you know, this isn't any good. Now, the reason they did away with that is because it held up everything else. You couldn't get anything else done during a filibuster. And now, just by notice, you know, committees can meet, you can act on other bills. So, but if you're really concerned about the filibuster being abused, and I think we can both agree it's been abused by both sides, that this is the way around it. At least make them get up there and put their mouth where they're, you know, make them get up on the floor and spend some nights there. I was a page from 1963 to 1967 when they had those filibusters. We had cots set up in the Senate. As pages, we would work in shift. We went to school at 6 in the morning, but we would sometimes stay all night and we'd work in shifts. The nice thing about that is you didn't have to go to school the next day. But they've gotten so far away from this where this is just all 60-vote threshold, and as a result of that, everything is filibustered, and nothing happens. So that's you could get around it a little bit and make it at least hurt everybody a little bit if you do that instead of just filing a notice. But doing away with the 60-vote threshold, if you do that, it's going to come back to bite you at some point, just like it did for liberals with the Supreme Court nominees and the courts that Trump was able to pack, and also the regulatory agencies where he put people in that never would have been nominated if you had a 60-vote threshold. They would have been forced to sit down and negotiate them. So pick your poison. But I think what looks good today may not look good in 2 years if Republicans were to take everything, or 3 years if Republicans were to take everything, you'd rue the day. And you got to play the long game.
What do you think of our argument, Congressman, that it should be suspended for voting rights, especially the D.C. statehood bill, because no state has ever entered the union with that threshold? No state has ever had to meet 60 votes to get into the a union. Well, in fact, many states have only gotten in by one or two votes.
Yeah, look, you can have the argument, but once you make an exception for one thing, you make an exception for other things. And the exceptions that you have today, which is the Budget Act, you've got it for some appointments under the Congressional Review Act, very, very, very few. Those were done with 60 votes when they changed those rules for those, you know, legislatively. It's a good argument. I think what the district needs to do, you've got to play the long game on this. I would have taken the House vote. The Democrats in the Senate, who had filibustered my House vote, passed it, and they couldn't get it through the House because there was a gun amendment on there. And everybody said, well, we don't want to take it with a gun amendment. I just say, take it and get rid of the gun stuff later. You know, you got to be practical. You'll never get – don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You could have had a vote in the House, and then you come back later – and you get what you can, but trying to score that 99-yard pass when you can get a couple first downs, to me, is not the way I'd play the game. Secondly is, you know, I think over time you can get Republicans to support it, but as long as it's a one-party city, it's going to just – the threshold gets very high and the pain level very high. And as, you know, Republicans use this as an arguing point to their base, well, they're trying to stuff two Democratic senators down the base. By the way, they say the same thing for Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico is not a Democratic bastion. Puerto Rico has a lot of Republicans. In fact, their delegate, their resident commissioner is a Republican.
Yeah, and also their delegation is two Republicans, two Democrats, and an independent. So they're following your advice of trying to keep it
right.
I don't know. Keep moving forward that way.
The difference for Puerto Rico is they don't pay federal taxes.
Right.
D.C. does.
They don't.
It's just hard with a straight face to say you can't have congressional representation. I mean, the other thing that Gingrich and Jack Kemp, we talked about, is, you don't want to give them a vote? Don't make them pay taxes. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, my constituents in the 11th District would be happy to get rid of me and give up my vote if they didn't have to pay taxes.
Yeah,
but,
and D.C.
but
too.
Taxation was there, it's a strong argument.
Oh, yeah.
My house sits on the dividing line between D.C. and Maryland. So you take away my taxes, my property value goes way up. But let me ask you, This really bothers me, is that there's all this talk about voting rights all over America. This is all we're talking about right now, and not one single word about D.C. Not one single word about 700,000 people that are disenfranchised. It's like, you know, you've already spelled out what the Republicans' problem with statehood for D.C. is. It's a partisan thing. But for Democrats, it seems like this is our dirty little secret or something, and we don't want it to interfere with our push for voting rights, so we're just going to sweep it under the rug and not talk about it. What do you think about that?
So look, you had 60 votes with Obama in the Senate. That was the time to go for it. They could have done immigration. They could have done it, and they went and did some other things. And I'll just say it just wasn't the priority. But secondly, let me just say that I'll be a little controversial on this voter rights stuff. I think I understand it pretty well. This is, you know, in Georgia, it's a 15-day election day now. You have 15 days where you can vote in person. You can go to a drop box. There is no excuse absentee balloting. If you want to vote in Georgia, you can vote. It's about getting people out to vote who don't want to vote and convincing them, and in some cases harvesting ballots. And I think it's been grossly exaggerated by the Democrats in terms, I mean, comparing it to Jim Crow is absurd when Georgia's laws, and I'd be happy to have this, are more liberal than Delaware or New York. New York just turned down some of those efforts for no excuse absentee ballots. The voters turned it down 55-45. They're not all racists. They recognize what's going on. People don't like the harvesting of ballots and everything else going on this. I think the Democrats are talking in an echo chamber to each other when they talk about this kind of thing. And the average person is saying, how is this helping me? Because they recognize that most people who want to vote, it's just not a problem. And you take away a photo ID from the end, and they're saying, what are you doing? I would say the Republicans have a similar problem, and that they're yelling about an election that was stolen that wasn't stolen. If anybody had a right to complain about a stolen election, I'd look at Al Gore, who goes to the Supreme Court in a 5-4 vote, which he was claimed sort of party line. And what did he do? He walked away from it. Trump was a very sore loser on something. And look, if there was cheating, fine, but you couldn't prove it in court, and we have to go along with what the court said, and it's absurd. So I think both sides on this thing are just way out of the mainstream with what they're looking at. It is about harvesting ballots. There are a lot of people, and Democrats believe this, and particularly of lower income, lower educated voters who don't tend to participate in large numbers, that sending them absentee ballots, being able to go out and harvest these ballots, and it will help them politically. In Virginia this time, we have some expanded franchise law. So they expanded the ballot in Virginia. They took away photo ID. They expanded in-person voting. They made absentee voting 45 days. You could have 45 days for in-person absentee voting, and you had no excuse absentee voting. And here's what happened. 4 years ago, we'd had record turnouts for governor. Northam blew through it and brought a Democratic legislature in. And McAuliffe got 200,000 more Democratic votes than Northam. And they thought, aha, we're going to win. But guess what? Youngkin brought in 500,000 more Republicans. Republicans yearned to use that in these rural areas. And they went out there and they did the same thing. And they end up not just winning, but those votes that you harvest in that way and that you bring in that, they do not split their tickets. They're party line votes, as you know. And the Republicans end up winning 7 seats in the legislature and taking control of the state house and sweeping all statewide elections. It's a very two-edged sword, but to comparing these laws to Jim Crow, for anybody, it's you know, for Biden to do that is as outrageous as anything Trump did in terms of voting laws and stuff. They're just so far out of the mainstream of what's real. I know these are real issues to some people. They should be. We need to keep it. But in terms of the way this is applied on the ground and in states like at this point, the disparity that is talked about in the rhetoric is nowhere near the reality. That's my opinion.
Well, you know, I'd love to argue the point with you, Congressman, but we're out of time. And you've been an amazing guest.
I'm filibustering.
Yes, being filibustered. And you've been an amazing guest. And you've always been a friend to the people of the District of Columbia, and I thank you for that. We, as Marilia has already said, we miss you in Congress. We could use more moderate Republicans like you. And we're going to leave you with the song tonight. We always leave with the song. And all this right. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. In honor of you, Congressman Tom Davis, and be nice to my friend Audrey there at Holland tonight.
I will do that. I'll go up and see her next time she's in the office.
Yeah, right. and we hope that you'll come back.
Well, thank you both for thank you both for giving me the chance, Mike.
Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you.
Okay,
and we'll see you next week. We'll see you next week, folks, when our guest will be the Reverend Jesse Jackson. So, thank you, Marilia. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Senator.